nothing's wrong. Nothing's wrong at all. That's just trumpeter Arturo Sandoval displaying his skill with Mambo Influenciado. That was recorded in 1988. The Mambo part, reflecting his Afro-Cuban roots, the Influenciado part, reflecting his deep immersion in bebop and jazz, and tribute, his personal tribute to his mentor, Dizzy Gillespie. Sandoval shares the rich Afro-Cuban jazz tradition with Chucho Valdez, also on this album. You hear him on piano. They're both masters of the instruments, from classical to classical jazz. Sandoval, by the way, was one of 16 distinguished Americans recently awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian order. Excuse me, the nation's highest civilian honor. You also heard Ron Mathewson on bass, Martin Drew on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Yatrice Lead with a very strange voice. It's Friday, November the 29th, and Marissa Alexander, the Jacksonville, Florida woman awaiting a new trial in a controversial Stand Your Ground case, is free on bond, but awaiting another trial. Alexander was released from jail on Wednesday, but must remain under house arrest while awaiting trial. She was sentenced to a mandatory 20-year sentence last year for firing what she insisted was a warning shot during a spat with her ex-husband. She tried to invoke Florida's Stand Your Ground law, but the judge threw out the case, which she claimed was self-defense. An appeals court ruled in September that the judge in the case gave improper jury instructions. You will recall that we heard from her appeals lawyer explaining the details of the appeals. So it's a good thing. She's out and then would be given a new trial. And we talked about that as well. Well, what I want to talk about today is, of course, you know, today is what is referred to in the industry as Black Friday. It's one of the few times that the word black is associated with something beautiful. And the beautiful part is cash. That's black is green. Okay. As sales calendars go, we are officially in the holiday season, the time of year when U.S. consumer spending is prodded by custom and by huge advertising budgets to its peak. The holiday season accounts for between 20% and 40% of retailers' annual sales. Despite the downturn in the economy, the National Retail Federation is predicting that holiday sales will grow by 3.9% this year, to $602.1 billion. Human misery, but corporate profits. Today we ponder the theory by Dr. Raj Sisodia, a professor of global business, that capitalism can have a heart. It can be a win-win proposition. In fact, he says, several leading companies are proof that what he calls conscious capitalism works to the benefit of everyone. We're going to hear Dr. Sisodia explain this concept of conscious capitalism. By the way, he is the co-author with John Mackey, the founder and CEO of Whole Foods Market, of his book, Conscious Capitalism, Liberating the Heroic Spirit of Business. He also had written Firms of Endearment, How World-Class Companies Profit from Passion and Purpose. We're going to hear a nice little clip from an interview that he did at this year's Libertarian Annual Conference that was held in Las Vegas. Here's Dr. Raj Sisodia discussing his concept of conscious capitalism. After the clip, we'll come back and discuss greater details. But let's first deal with this clip.
Conscious capitalism?
It's a different way of thinking about business. We've for long had this sort of narrow narrative and definition of what business is about and what the purpose of business is, which is about profit maximization for shareholders. And that's something that the economists really created as a definition of business purpose. This is about thinking of business in a much more realistic and richer way, that successful great businesses really are built on a platform of higher purpose. There's something that they're trying to do in the world that is worth doing. They're trying to create value in a certain way, which is meaningful to people, not only to customers, but to employees and to communities and suppliers and society at large. Secondly, they think about value creation not just in terms of shareholders and treating them as an end and everybody else as a means, but they actually think about all of their stakeholders as ends in themselves. So a business that is focused on creating value for its employees in their lives, meaning and purpose, not only but all of their stakeholders as ends in themselves. So a business that is focused on creating value for its employees in their lives, meaning and purpose, not only earning a living, is focused, of course, on creating value for customers and improving the quality of their life, not just creating value for customers and improving the quality of their life, not just trying to sell them more stuff. It is creating value for suppliers, it's creating value for the community, it's improving the environment, etc. So it's trying to create value for all stakeholders and do it in a way that does not require trade-offs, that says that you can actually simultaneously enhance the well-being of all stakeholders if you think about it creatively. If you think about it in a traditional way, then you end up with a lot of trade-offs. So these businesses tend to reject trade-offs. The third is that the leaders of these companies are what we call conscious leaders, that they are actually motivated first and foremost by the purpose of the organization and by service to all of the stakeholders. And they are much less driven by power or personal enrichment. So conscious leaders are missionary leaders, they're not military style or mercenary leaders. And the last is that these kinds of businesses tend to have a unique culture, a culture of authenticity and trust, transparency, and I think most importantly, love and care. That these businesses are built on love and care and not fear and stress. A lot of businesses tend to operate with a lot of fear and stress. That seems like the fuel that they think is what they need to get people to work hard and keep them motivated. The old carrots and sticks approach. And these businesses realize that it's really not about that. That's not when you get human beings acting to their highest potential. It's when they are driven internally by a sense of purpose, by a sense of meaning, by getting respect and autonomy, and by having the opportunity to grow within their work, so that their work becomes not just a job or even a career, but a calling. So those are the elements that comprise this. The interesting thing, my research that was in a book that came earlier a few years ago called Firms of Endearment, show that those kinds of businesses create multiple kinds of value for all their stakeholders. And if you just focus on the financial, well, it turns out that these businesses actually outperform the market by a 9-to-1 ratio over a 10-year period. And now we've added 5 more years of data, so it's actually 10.5-to-1. Right? So this is showing that this is not about trade-offs. It doesn't say that you can make money for investors, but to do that you must squeeze your customers, or you squeeze your employees, or squeeze your suppliers, or externalize burdens onto society. You don't need to do any of that. You simultaneously create positive value in all of those dimensions for all of the stakeholders. And that's, I think, the power and beauty of this way of thinking about business.
Do you consider conscious capitalism to be an evolutionary step in our capitalist system?
In a way, it is. I think the seeds of this were there in the beginning when business used to have a well-defined moral sort of dimension to it. And most of the great businesses that were created really started with some kind of, and in many cases it came from a religious background. But I think what happened that over time, that got taken out as we had more publicly traded companies, as the economists came in, etc., as we started to have these laws of incorporation and the definition of fiduciary responsibility got narrowed down to the point where, you're told that you must always look to maximize shareholder value, otherwise you'll get fired or you'll get sued. I think that kind of got lost in the process. So we lost that moral, ethical, human, emotional, spiritual dimension of work. And work really is a fundamental thing in our life. And as Freud said, work and love are the cornerstones of our humanness, but we have separated those in the past. Right? We've completely created workplaces devoid of any caring and feeling and the power of love. And I think now we're bringing that together. I do think it's evolutionary in the sense that we as human beings are evolving very rapidly and the world is changing quite dramatically. So if you just look in the last 20 years, how much the world has changed. 1989 was a real turning point. Not only did we have the collapse of communism and the birth of a whole bunch of new free market economies, but we also had that year the Exxon Valdez oil spill. We had that year the invention of the World Wide Web, which has fundamentally transformed the world. It has created a world of almost total information transparency and egalitarianism. We also had that year, interestingly, a demographic threshold was crossed where we had more adults over 40 than below in this country. So it's the aging of the population. And the median age of adults is now 44. What that means is society as a whole is now driven by midlife values. The midlife values are much more around meaning and purpose and interconnectedness and what kind of legacy am I going to leave behind, and it's less about self and less about material. So more and more people are now inherently motivated by those kinds of things. We're also becoming more connected, of course. You know, we have now more phone numbers than we have people on this planet. We have Facebook with over 1 billion members, right? So we are woven together into this fabric, seamless fabric. So we almost have a shared central nervous system of all humanity. We know everything that's going on, and we can share it with each other. And add to that the fact that we are becoming more intelligent at a rapid rate. There's something called the Flynn effect that shows that our human IQ is rising 3 to 4% every 10 years for the last 7 or 8 decades that they've got the data. So what it means is that the average person with 100 IQ today, if you take them back to 1918, they would be in the top 2%. Of intelligence. They would be considered a near genius, and they're merely average today. And lastly, we have much more education. So a century ago, only 9% of Americans finished high school, now 40% go to college. And the impact in some countries like South Korea is 70 plus, and the impact is most dramatic on women. Right? So that's a great equalizer, higher access to higher education, that now 60% or more of students in the U.S. are women at the college level, and even higher at the graduate school level. They're getting higher grades. And what that means is that almost every white-collar profession will be statistically dominated by women in years to come. And that will fundamentally transform the nature of society. It's the rise of feminine values. It's the feminization of the culture. It's the growth of nurturing, caring relationships, long-term thinking, you know, win-win outcomes, rather than the masculine approach of domination, aggression, competition, and winning at all costs. And I think the last part of that is that our journey of rising consciousness. You know, if you look at all the markers, I mean, 150 years ago we had slavery, of course, right? Everywhere in the world. That was part of the human condition in every civilization going back, and now we cannot imagine it. 100 years ago, women could not vote, right? And that's everywhere in the world, and now we cannot imagine that. 75 years ago, we still had colonialism. 50 years ago, we still had segregation. And 30 years ago, we had all kinds of environmental and animal and child labor and all kinds of abuses. 20 years ago, we still had apartheid. You know, the things are changing rapidly. And these are all, you know, evolutionary markers of our higher consciousness, that we recognize all of the consequences of our actions. We have a finer sense of right and wrong. And that which was acceptable to us in the past will not be acceptable in the future. And I think that standard will continue to evolve in the future. So the key thing for business is, you know, most businesses were created, or the operating system for business was defined way back in the industrial age based on a military metaphor, and we're still largely operating on that. So businesses haven't adapted to the new realities. People are very different, the world is very different, our concerns are very different, our needs are very different, what inspires us, what motivates us is very different. And you can't use the old approaches. You know, almost everything we thought we knew was wrong about how to run a business, how to motivate people, etc.
Professor Sisodia, how does that fit in? We're here at the Freedom Fest Libertarian Conference. How does conscious capitalism fit into libertarianism?
Yeah, I think part of our purpose, if you look at the subtitle of our book, it's Liberating the Heroic Spirit of Business. And I think that's what this conference is very much about. It's a celebration of economic and political freedom. And business is fundamentally a reflection of that. In our society, we tend to look down on business. We have a very negative narrative out there that business is about selfishness and exploitation and greed. And therefore, the more you can be selfish and exploitative, that's the more successful you will be, you know, in business. And that is simply not true. So I think we have to change that toxic narrative about business out there, recognize that entrepreneurs are the real value creators in this world, right? The businesses actually elevate humanity. We have a credo in there that we are four fundamental beliefs that business is good because it's based on the creation of value. If you don't create value, you don't survive. That business is ethical because it's based on voluntary exchange. Unlike the government, I cannot force you to do anything. I can't force anybody to be a customer, a supplier, an employee, etc. But more than that, business is noble because it elevates our existence. You know, for most of human history, most of humanity lived a subsistence level existence, right? Where basically they're just trying to survive, almost animalistic. And there was no scope for people to explore what it actually means to be human. And now the prosperity that we've created in the last two centuries, where per capita income has gone from $500 to about $8,000 worldwide, where life expectancy has gone from 30 to 68 or so, where, you know, literacy has gone up, where our population has gone from 1 billion to 7 billion. So many more of us now can actually aspire to the higher things in life. We can explore art and literature. You know, as an expression goes, this planet used to be molten lava, and now it sings opera. Where does that come from? You know, where do people have the, I'm not talking about ordinary people, have the ability now to engage in these things. And lastly, business is heroic, because it lifts people out of poverty. Governments and nonprofits and religious organizations cannot sustainably lift people out of poverty. They can help in short-term emergency situations, but they cannot create sustainable means for people to elevate their existence. And just in the last 20 years, you know, 500 million Chinese and 300 million Indians and many, many others around this planet have seen their lives fundamentally altered. There are tens of millions of people who are alive today who would not be alive were it not for the spread of freedom and the spread of free markets. So we're very much in alignment with what this event is about. What we also say, however, is that you can actually make it even better. That when business is fundamentally good when it's done, you know, with purity and with free markets and without crony capitalism and without all of the kinds of distortions. But then if you apply a higher consciousness to it, the potential for value creation just explodes to an even higher level. Because then you start to see the bigger picture and you start to see the interconnectedness. So we start to treat business as it should be treated, as this living organism, not as a machine where you put some inputs and you get some outputs, but as this living thing that needs to flourish. And when it does, it creates all kinds of things in the world. So we're very much, as I said, in harmony. My co-author, John Mackey, has been a regular at this event for many years. He's actually in Africa right now.
Who is John Mackey?
John is the co-founder and co-CEO of Whole Foods Market, which is a company that in many ways represents what we talk about in conscious capitalism.
Well, you have a chart in here. How does Whole Foods fit into the 10As that you described?
Yeah, so this chart shows that at the core of it are the purpose and core values. What do we believe in? And what are we trying to do? Why was Whole Foods created? It was a company that started in Austin in 1978 with the original name Safer Way, which is a play on Safeway. And what they were saying was that, no, that is actually not safe. It's a safer way for you to eat food that is actually more natural and whole and less processed and has less artificial ingredients and so forth. So their fundamental premise and their passion was to educate people that what you put into your body makes a difference to your health. And it makes a difference to the health of the planet and the food system. Right? And that's their core driving energy behind them, that sense of purpose. And that is more relevant today than even when they started. Right? Because our healthcare spending used to be 5.7% in 1960, now we're close to 19%. Our food spending used to be about 16%, now we're down to 8%. Right? So if you look at those two trend lines, we're buying a lot more cheap calories, but guess what? We're paying for it with our health. Fundamentally, you know, it's unsustainable. So their purpose is what drives them. That is why they exist. They're not just another food retailer trying to sell you groceries and make money. There's a passion behind their existence. Secondly, they look at all of their stakeholders as interconnected and interdependent. In fact, they have a document, very interesting one on their website, crafted by their employees, called the Declaration of Interdependence. And it says that we're all interdependent and interconnected, our customers, employees, farmers, suppliers, communities, the environment, even activists and others, that we are all interconnected, interdependent, and therefore when we make decisions in the company, we must consider the consequences for all and not simply look at, okay, I need to improve you know, margins and profits, and therefore what, you know, we need to think about what are the consequences for all and try to come up with win-win-win-win-win across all stakeholders. And that takes a lot of creativity. It's very easy to find trade-offs. Most managerial decision-making tends to be trade-off driven. But if you reject the idea of trade-offs, then you can actually come up with synergies. They also have a very egalitarian culture inside. The highest pay at Whole Foods cannot exceed 19 times the average pay. Now, for comparison, publicly traded companies in the U.S., that ratio has varied between 350 and 500 to 1 in recent years. It used to be 30, 40, 50, then became 100 to 1. You know, it has risen dramatically over the last few decades. At Whole Foods, they have captured at 19. And there's a fundamental belief in egalitarianism there. Their frontline people are paid better than average, but people at the top are paid relatively modestly compared to their peers at other companies. So the chief financial officer at this company might make $700,000, you know, at another company might make $8 million, right? But the reason they do that is that they want people who are driven by purpose and by service, who care about the business, who are not just hired hands, mercenary leaders who will work for anything as long as you pay them, right? They find that these leaders are more effective, they're more inspirational, right? And they're ultimately more successful, you know, as a company. And then, of course, the internal culture also responds to that. You know, when people can look around and, by the way, total transparency, everybody knows what everybody else gets paid at Whole Foods. You know, if you want to find out, you can do that. And therefore, it places a greater onus on fairness and equity within the company. So those are some of the elements. And when you do all of that, you create that virtuous cycle that's depicted in that diagram that you were looking at, you know, that you start with creating value for your team members. They get engaged, inspired. You know, they will then provide a great experience for customers, making sure that their needs are well met, etc., who will then become loyal shoppers. You don't need to spend a lot of money on marketing. That's another interesting dimension. How I got involved in all of this was looking for companies that did not spend much at all on marketing and yet had customers who loved them. Because most companies in America spend a lot of money on marketing and customers really don't care. They are not loyal and they don't trust them. These companies actually have very high levels of customer loyalty and trust, but they don't need to spend money on ads and gimmicks and coupons and, you know, sales and all of that kind of thing. So when you do that, then of course that leads to higher revenue, higher sales per square foot, etc., greater efficiencies with which you operate, higher margins, happy investors. That then allows you the resources to be able to, you know, donate things into the community, to do things for society, but also invest back into growth. And the idea is these are highly profitable companies, and Whole Foods is one of the most successful public companies out there. But their purpose is not profit. Their purpose is their purpose. And higher profits enable them to fulfill their purpose. Right? So they can now have a greater impact on people's health and well-being, because now they're a $13 billion company versus when they were just starting out with a few stores. And when they get to 1,000 stores, they're 350 today, they will have an even greater positive impact. Right? So that's the driver. You know, profits are not the purpose. The purpose is defined by them, separate from profit. But being profitable is very important, because if you're not, then you can't achieve your purpose.
Well, how about that? That was Dr. Raj Sisodia, the proponent of this concept called conscious capitalism. And the way he describes a company is decidedly different from the way we envision companies working, and our direct experience with companies and how they work. So the question to you is, will conscious capitalism ever take hold in the United States, knowing what we know about our culture? What is the prognosis for conscious capitalism in the United States? We'll take your comments and questions right after this short break. You're listening to PRN.FM. I'm Utrice Lead, and the program is Lead Stories. We were talking about the concept of conscious capitalism as defined by Dr. Raj Sisodia, author with the founder and CEO of Whole Foods Market, of this book called Conscious Capitalism. And it talks about creating a win-win-win all the way around so that capitalism doesn't have to be a zero-sum game, as I've been talking before, where somebody loses because somebody has to win. It's not one of those things that he calls a trade-off. He says it's about creating an atmosphere within the culture of a company or corporation so that people are there driven by passion and purpose, and of course also by profits. They'll make profits, but the idea is to have a business fill as many needs as possible, seeing it not as an either-or proposition, but that everybody can be served by a well-functioning company, a company that has its head on right with respect to how to function in an environment as a benefit to the community. 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888 is the number to call, and let's continue the conversation. Let's see what your thoughts are. You know, I was reading some pretty interesting statistics from the National Retail Federation and the kind of money that they're talking about. As I quoted, $602.1 billion would be spent by consumers in just 60 days in November and December. And when you consider the fact that the economy is stalled, it hasn't grown very much, and in fact is in a downspin, but certain sectors are doing quite well. The retail sector obviously is doing quite well and will be doing quite well, experiencing almost a 4% growth this year alone. So that this is what I was talking about when I referred to zero sum. While people suffer, there is genuine suffering in the United States. There's a lot of poverty. There's a lot of unemployment, homelessness, and other social ills. But juxtaposing that, you see the sector of the economy, the retail sector, just booming. If you turn on your television today, you would be seeing a story about people literally fighting each other to get into the stores so that they could spend money they don't have on things they don't need. It's an interesting phenomenon. So the issue of conscious capitalism is to engender an entire reworking of the thinking, both in terms of how a company functions, but also how consumers function. We talked earlier in the week about this shop and frisk, where people are, you know, working poor, to be very honest. Working class is an upgrade, but I would say they're just working poor people. The two young people, one who spent almost $350 on a belt and another who spent $2,500 on a pocketbook. They certainly are not people who you would describe as wealthy, where this amount of money would be considered incidental in their lives. You know, if you have the kind of money that a billionaire has, $350 on a belt is no big deal. But these consumer items are purchased most often by people who cannot really afford them. But they invest so much in these products because they think it's a reflection on them personally, that it says something about them, that they have achieved a certain status or they want certain attention to be given to them as people who have achieved a certain status. They're not fooling anybody. Everybody could tell, you know, just by looking at them. But, you know, you're not of money. You're not of that kind of money, certainly. But still, the society pushes us in that direction. It pushes us into a state of unconsciousness. that we continue to spend money that we don't have on things we don't need. So when you juxtapose misery with profits, you see that there's something totally out of balance here. And this is what Dr. Sirdosya is talking about. Is talking about. How do you get to the point of realigning business? Because it doesn't have to be one of those things where businesses don't profit. You do need to profit. You do need to make a profit. You have to pay bills. You have to have extra money to reinvest in your business and pay employees and so forth. You'd have those responsibilities. And the purpose of business in the first place is to generate some kind of profit. There's nothing wrong with that. But he's saying that even that premise can be revised, where you make profits, you run an efficient business, you pay your employees well, and you provide a product to a community, to a consumer base that can use your product and that benefits them. And that was the example he raised of Whole Foods. So our system, is it down, our system? We don't know. 888-874-4888. We went down for a little while, I understand. But hopefully we'll be back in good graces again. What are your thoughts? Is it possible in the United States to see this movement growing? Or is it going to be one of those peripheral things, given the ravenous nature of established businesses, of the established system, which is no mercy? You know, you go into business, literally, they use words like kill. We got to kill the competition. We have to obliterate our competitors. We've got to just put them out of business. And that's the nature of business. Businesses, you know, I have to survive. And because I have to survive, I have to make sure you don't survive. If I'm in business and I have a bakery, and there's a bakery, you know, reasonable proximity to mine, my job is to do everything possible to put that other bakery out of business. That is considered good business practice. Good business practice is not just to beat the competition. Listen to these words. They're not very kind. To beat the competition and preferably to force them out of business. You have in the business world the concept of hostile takeovers, businesses that ravenously gobble each other up simply to maximize profits. And in maximizing profits, what does it mean? If we're thinking in this zero-sum discussion that we've been having, the thinking is you squeeze the employees. What's going on now about this business of establishing a minimum wage in places like Walmart and others, a higher minimum wage? The idea is these mega companies making money hand over fist, the last thing they want to do is pay a living wage because of zero-sum thinking. If we make millions and billions of dollars, if we give you 5 cents more an hour, it cuts into our profits. So our job as the stewards of corporate America, our job as corporate stewards is to maximize profits, even if, and especially if, it means we have to hold the line against being fair to our employees, give them a working wage, have them working under sane conditions, give them benefits that they deserve, that will make them happy with their jobs, and therefore it would result in loyalty to the company. The business of loyalty doesn't work anymore because companies have made it really hard for people to feel good about working any place because they feel exploited, they feel cheated, they feel demeaned. They're just cogs in the wheel. Oh, you don't like your job? Fine. Get out. In half an hour, there'd be somebody there to take your place. And that's the way it is. So why don't we look at this alternative? Is this namby-pamby kind of, you know, pie-in-the-sky thinking by this Dr. Sisodia? Is he talking that Deepak Chopra kind of find your chakras and go to work and, you know, just meditate? No. He is saying we have to make a choice. At some point, and I think we're getting there, at some point, the environment will become toxic. The environment will become so toxic that businesses will start failing. I mean, they're doing great now. And in fact, that's another way of capitalism. There isn't very much in terms of long-range planning, because the mentality is so, you know, moment to moment. We can change moment to moment. The long-term intent is to make profits by any means necessary. But it does not necessarily mean that they bring the workers along. Workers are purely expendable. Most workers, anyway, are expendable. So they're not formed as companies to retain long-term, you know, fidelity and loyalty to a company. The company doesn't have that feeling of fidelity and loyalty to its employees. This will eventually cause a catastrophe within the world of business, because workers at some point will draw the line. They've already begun to do so, as you can see. Many workers are walking off their jobs. We have the advent of anti-unionism taking firm hold in the United States. Workers are reacting against that. I think the unions have decided to become very weak, by the way, and in some cases have been betraying their constituencies by working hand in glove with management and the corporate owners. The world of work essentially will change so dramatically that it will force the corporate culture to change itself. And if more and more consumers use their consumer dollars wisely and strategically, there can be an even greater influence on the way companies behave and change their culture. And it will, in the end, benefit the society as a whole. I'm informed that we may not be getting calls because of things. We had a little setback here with our system, but it's back up, and hopefully we can get some calls before long at 888-874-4888. So this is what I think is most instructive about what we listened to, just explaining this concept of conscious capitalism. Consumers have a lot of power. Why? Because we decide where to put our money. And this is whether you're rich or poor, or working poor, or just working class, or whatever have you, middle class, whatever have you. Everybody somehow has money. For example, you can decide, if you are on public assistance, you decide where you spend your money. When you go to the grocery store, you decide that. That's huge. That's a huge part of the economy. You decide how you're going to run your household efficiently, and therefore you make very good decisions, one hopes, on how you spend those dollars. We can send messages to that sector of the economy that is misbehaving, that's plundering the consumer and really giving workers a really bad time. if you make one or two adjustments in how you spend your money. Oh, look, we have a call, our very first. Hello, Jay. You got through. Thank you so much. You're on
here. How are you, Trees? I'm going to be very, very quick. I would just like to say the examples of the behavior of corporations should be like Costco's. You know, Costco gives their workers a very good wage. They treat their workers fairly, and they have low turnover because of the loyalty of the workers. So I think that should be the example of the way a corporation should act and respond with their workers. And I'll listen offline, and have a good day.
You too. Well, we'll see how people think, whether they think Costco is, in fact, a fair company to its employees. You find that, I don't know to what degree, the question is, from the union perspective, how Costco rates. Maybe we'll get another call from somebody who says, well, they have direct information about Costco. So how we spend our money really dictates in many ways how the economy would go. When we turn on the television as we do today and we see people who have no reason, there is no compelling reason really for people to be getting up early in the morning. These are working people and unemployed people and part-time people. Getting up early, getting that credit card, getting online, waiting in the mass crowd assembled before Walmart and Macy's and whatever have you, to fly into that store and just buy like crazy. That is really bizarre. That is really bizarre. So could you tell me, what do you say to people like that? How do you re-educate those folks who say, you know, the heck with it, come Christmas morning, my child better have an Xbox or a new bike or, you know, some other game or the other. These are the habits inculcated in consumers, and consumer habits are what drive this $1 trillion retail economy. I'm just hoping that we can find a way to retrain ourselves. And I think it starts within the family. Families have to start a process of re-education about how you retrain everybody to understand the value of a dollar, not just what it could buy, but how it can be leveraged, how it can be used in a political sense, because that is where the change has to occur. Running out there spending money like you're a nut. It's not supposed to be that way. It's supposed to be that you've grown up a bit. So we'll be coming back to this very often. We'll be coming back to this topic of conscious capitalism, conscious consumerism, and we'll be talking about this in the context of that zero-sum thing. I'm telling you, that's a huge part of the mindset. The fact that you have to have winners and losers. Somebody benefits because somebody else does not. Somebody is wealthy because it necessitates somebody being not wealthy. I have because you don't. And that's the mentality in the United States. It's never been everybody can have. Everybody can share. You know, it's funny that you point to some of these societies that people encounter in the deep jungles and remote areas that they call primitive. But look at it. If there is food, everybody will eat. Everybody goes out to find food so that everybody can eat. Children are everybody's concern. The elderly are cared for. Everybody's concerned. So these people have very highly developed senses of community. And comparatively speaking, are functioning at a much higher level than many industrialized nations, because their concern is that everybody ought to have a part of whatever is seen as community property. Everybody participates. We call them primitive. Isn't that odd? And yet our own society is so backward. It is unbelievable, so heartless, so inhumane. So we'll be talking about these things. I'm so sorry that we had a little glitch today, but that's okay. Sometimes these things happen, we'll make up for it. I certainly believe that we will. So thank you so much for joining me today, and we'll pick up on Monday. A great program ahead on Monday, and I hope you'll join me for that. I wish you would start telling people that you know that PRN.fm is where you come to for alternative information, and that Lead Stories, of course, is your favorite program, naturally. Wake Up Call with Richard Martin is next. I want to thank you so much for joining me today, and we'll pick up again next week. Bye-bye.